It's Border Crossings with Larry London from VOA 1.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and we welcome you to another great Border Crossing special. Today, we welcome Matthew and Gunnar Nelson to the show. They are promoting a brand new remastered version of a classic album for them, and they're going to be talking about the album and singing some great songs, some songs that'll bring back some memories. They're going to sing one of their biggest hits and one of their father's biggest hits. Yes, they came from music royalty, their dad, Ricky Nelson. We'll hear about dad, we'll hear about grandpa and grandma Ozzy and Harriet Nelson, and we'll also hear about the guys in the band Nelson. All of that's coming up for you right here on Border Crossings. Hi, this is Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings. In our studios and on tour right now for a lot of great music, a lot of great hits, and a remastered version of a classic album from their collection of great hits. We've got Gunnar and Matthew Nelson. Nelson are in the studios today. Welcome to DC.
Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to know you. Yeah, no problem.
Obviously, you guys are tremendously talented. You come from a great music heritage. I'm going to mention this for the worldwide audience who are tuning in 100 countries around the world. The two brothers here are the sons of Ricky Nelson, who's a legendary music performer, rock and roll Hall of Famer. And so, I mean, it's got a, he played a significant part in you deciding what it was you wanted to do.
Well, it was great for us because we always had great social proof, you know, around the house. When we were babies, our first memories were of watching our father perform mm-hmm. with the Stone Canyon Band. And it was kind of neat. It's like any family that comes from that history of whatever it is that family does, for us, it was always around us. It was being done at the highest of levels. And it was just kind of what you did.
It was kind of our normal. I mean, if you think about it, too, our grandparents, Ozzy and Harriet, were musicians before they were actors.
Right.
And Ozzy had his own number one records in the 30s with Harriet singing lead for him. So we're, I guess, the only family so far in history with three successive generations of number one hit makers.
Right. And that's in the Guinness Book of World Records.
It is. And it's just kind of, if you think about it, it's just our normal. That's just something that, mm-hmm. that happened. And, of course, our mother's side of the family, too, was in show business, still is. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of neat to grow up knowing that... even though you still have friends that say, oh, why are you even trying? You'll never achieve such and such and such. For us, it was more like coming from a family of athletes, of famous athletes that were preparing for the Olympics. Mm-hmm. For us, it was just always something that we wanted to do, and we knew we had to be prepared for it. We just didn't know when that shot was going to happen, but we knew we had to be ready.
Mm-hmm. And you did come from a family of athletes. So you're, on your mother's side,
yeah,
you've got a Heisman Trophy winning grandfather who passed
right,
away
Tom Harmon.
Years ago, and then... you've got an uncle who's a tremendous actor and was also a great football player.
An amazing athlete. Our uncle Mark Harmon played quarterback for UCLA.
Right, right.
And his father, Tom Harmon, was one of the best that ever played the game. He was amazing. I mean, a triple threat and
Michigan,
and
1940. Mm-hmm. Two-year All-American, 39-40.
Wow. And so you decided sports wasn't your thing?
We loved doing it in high school and junior high. We really dug it. But I remember having a conversation with our uncle Mark because we asked him about that because he was really a talented athlete, very, very talented. He could have gone pro, no problem. But he said that it kind of hit him that all of his father's friends were coming over to visit, people he'd played football with, mm-hmm. and they were relatively young men, and they were all on crutches and canes and stuff. And he realized, man, you're one knee shot away from a completely different destiny. So we thought, okay, well, I think I'm going to start taking the acting classes.
I remember for Gunnar and I, Gunnar was great. He was a quarterback, and I was a wide receiver playing football. And I remember padding up, going out, playing the game. And we had been playing in our band for a while since we were kids. And I just remember I always caught the ball. But every once in a while you took a shot that really rung your bell. And I remember there's one thing. It was a game-winning touchdown. I caught it. Mm-hmm. But I got hit so hard by that middle linebacker. I mean, I saw stars, blacked out a little bit, held the ball up, still caught the ball in the end zone. And that was the moment I said, I am not going to be doing this anymore. I'm playing guitar. This hurts.
And so you guys, obviously Dad was supportive of going into music.
He was. I think in the beginning it was kind of a goof for him because we started really, really young.
Yeah, I mean, 12, I think.
Well, no, actually before that we got our first instruments when we were 6 years old. Mm-hmm. I got my first drum set. Matt got his first bass. And the parents at the time, we were living in kind of like a little gentleman farm there in Studio City, California. It was an old property, mm-hmm. But our parents put us out in the hayloft over the barn, so it was away from the house. And we could make a racket and all that. And then our dad was coming and going from the road as much as he was, like 300 shows a year. Mm-hmm. And he came back one day when we were about 10 or 11, he realized we hadn't stopped. You know, it was like our passion. It was the one thing that we loved doing. We would rush home after school and just pick up the instruments and jam together.
Mm-hmm. Play to records, that type of thing. I remember, I just think like any other parent that buys their kid an instrument, they figure, this is going to be for a second, and then they'll go on to the next thing. And we still have not grown up. Clearly, so we haven't gone on to the next thing.
And he produced some of your music, too.
Yeah, actually, you mentioned our 12th birthday. That mm-hmm. was really when it happened. We actually got surprised by our father for our first recording session. He produced it. He told us we were going to a dentist appointment, and no kid wants to do that on our 12th birthday. And so we went to a strange building thinking that we were going to get our teeth drilled or something. Mm-hmm. And we walked in. Our dad was there. Our instruments were set up, and it was a big surprise. And he produced our first session. Matt wrote a song. And the Pointer Sisters wound up singing backup.
Wow.
I played drums, Matt played bass.
Well, we didn't know it was them. It was just these cool ladies showed up and sang backup and had some cake.
They?
And yeah.
Right.
And our dad's guitar player, John Beelan, played guitar. And uh-huh. and that was really cool. You know, it was sobering, too. It was the first time we actually heard ourselves recorded. And boy, we sounded like the Chipmunks and stuff. But if the fuse had been set, it definitely was lit that day.
Mm-hmm. I remember our mother actually realizing that they had completely created monsters that day. You know, we got home and almost wore the tape out. You know, it was like the first cassette tapes were out at that mm-hmm. point. And we really did. We wore a wear spot on that tape that first night. And our mom looked at our dad and said, I really think we screwed up with this.
Yeah, we just lost the boys.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really true. You know, the cool thing, though, is when your first memory is of watching somebody you love and admire so much doing that, and for us it was watching our father perform when he would play at Knott's Berry Farm in Southern California. Funny enough, kids never we never missed an amusement park show when he played there. But from that point on, you know, it was a real blessing for us to always know what the true north in our compass was. Mm-hmm. We didn't necessarily know the how, and we didn't know the when, but we always knew the what. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of friends that were living more, you know, using air quotes here, normal lives, that were going to college and still went all the way through college and didn't really know what it was they wanted to be passionate about and follow. And for us, for a lot of people, it was a pipe dream. Even though we came from the family we came from, I mean, if you think about the odds are just ridiculously stacked against anybody really catching a lick in this business, especially nowadays. I mean, I wouldn't know what to tell a kid nowadays other than getting on a karaoke show on TV to, like, try to break. But for us back then, there were a million people that wanted to be rock stars and wanted to play guitar and wanted to do all that. And the problem in our business is that when you're getting started, it's more so than any other corporate business where, like in any corporation, the ones that actually fail their way up to the top, the executives, are the ones that are always at all the meetings, they're at the parties, they're always seen places, but they never want to be the ones that actually sign their name on the dotted line in case a project of theirs fails. It's doubly so in the music business. And
it's triply so when you're related to somebody, because a failure on our end would be a high-profile failure and it would get somebody fired.
It would be a career-ender for somebody working A&R at a label. So it was very difficult for us to get signed. Mm-hmm. It had to get to the point where the writing was so undeniable and people could hear the money in the music on the corporate side of things that we finally got signed by John Kolodner, who was at the time very, very set in his career. He wasn't going anywhere. He was doing Aerosmith. He did Cher. He did Whitesnake. He was a superstar A&R guy when there really still was a rock and roll business.
For those folks out there, that stands for Artist and Repertoire.
Called Geffen Records, David right, Geffen, sure. The impresario. And it was a really great time for rock and roll. And John, for anybody who is a fan of vintage MTV, John Kolodner, the record company guy, was in the Dude Looks Like a Lady video for Aerosmith. He's the guy that turns around in the wedding dress with the mm-hmm. beard. He really looked like that. Not the wedding dress, but the beard. And so we actually, as we were developing, see, our father died when we were 18. And we had been playing the club scene in L.A. professionally from the time we were 12, really slogging it out, 5 shows a week, every week, and really trying to get that elusive record deal. And then when our father died, the last performance we did with that band, I was on drums, Matt was playing bass and up front, and we were the only unsigned band to be the musical guests on Saturday Night Live. And we did that show, and somehow on the plane on the way back, it just came to the two of us that something wasn't quite right. I was still back on the drums, and I just wanted to take a year off because everything was moving so quickly.
I mean, we were grieving, too. We didn't really know how to
sure.
deal with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, sure. And we wanted to do it the right way, and the press wasn't kind to our family at the time. So we wanted to take a year off, and I thought, well, you know, in that year, maybe I could actually learn how to play guitar, which I'd never played before, and come up front. And so that was really when Matt and I realized that was really what we did. We were the two brothers that completed each other's sentences. We sang harmony together. We did our thing. But it was going to be the two of us up front doing it together as, like, co-lead singers of a trip that was going to make it special. Mm-hmm. And that's when we started writing and working on a relationship with John Kolodner at Geffen. It took a couple few years to get actually the final nod to get a record deal. And then the rest just kind of happened. We had no idea that the first song we released that we had written was going to go number one.
Right.
But it was a very, very long overnight success.
It was, and I think our focus, more than a lot of our contemporaries that were coming out of the Los Angeles scene at the time and kind of coming out of that whole Sunset Strip thing, we never did that. You know, we had our club experience earlier when it was kind of the post-punk and L.A. New Wave type of thing. And even though we had long hair, we were closer to the Hollies and the Byrds and the Beach Boys and our dad's Stone Canyon band than, let's say, Guns N' Roses. We were not blues oriented. We were more of a almost kind of a pop folky thing.
Mm-hmm. It was an anomaly. It was kind of, and to this day, it's kind of one of those things where trying to pick an act for us to tour with is very difficult because we're not 1-4-5 blues. We're not Guns N' Roses. We never were. We really do come from more of that whole Southern California folky country rock thing. Mm-hmm. But it's cool because when you actually heard our first song, Love and Affection, on the radio, Man, that's the first time a combination
between the band America and Heart, mm-hmm. you know.
But it was the first time historically since Tambourine Man that a song went number one with a 12-string guitar as a featured instrument. Hmm. So it's pretty cool.
Did Dad ever get to hear you perform that song?
Oh, he did. Yeah. No, he heard
not that song. We hadn't written it yet.
Okay.
Yeah. But he definitely heard us perform. Actually opened the show for him a couple of times, and
he heard the club era. You know, Nelson's that, mm-hmm. that we, it was before we actually formed Nelson. We had a high school band called the Strange Agents. Mm. Now remember, this was kind of like a punk sort of Southern California time. The Skinny Tie Band era was in. So it seemed like every band had a name that started with the somethings. Mm-hmm. And that was our the something band. Our dad saw that.
Mm. Well, I'm going to have you do some music now. I mean, we've talked a lot, so we're going to talk some more. But let's hear something, if you guys wouldn't mind playing it.
Do you want something of ours or something of our dad's? What do you want to do?
What do you want to do? What are you in the mood to play for?
How about
us right
the one
now?
That went number one? The first song
Why
that went
not?
Number one.
Okay,
we could do that.
Set the bar
on
there.
These little speakers here, if we could, fellas. They're kind of off.
Yeah, if we could turn on the monitors.
There we go.
There we go. Nice.
Here she comes, just like an angel. Seems like forever that she's been on my mind. But nothing has changed. She thinks I'm a waste of her time. There she goes. No, she don't know what she's missing. Can't she see I'll never give up the fight? I'll do all I can till she understands my desire. I've been on the outside looking.
That was
great.
That was our 50s edit.
I love it.
Well,
I love
you.
It. It's Nelson as our guest here in the Voice of America studios today. And you guys, 4 number one MTV videos. That's fantastic. 5 top 20 hits. Of course, that among the biggest hits in your collection. That's fantastic. And
the new
re-released album or remastered album.
That's right. There's a lot of things about that that are very special to us. This has been, over 25 years now. I mean, I'm dating myself, but
yeah, it's 27 years.
27 years.
Ooh, who's counting?
Now, technology was different 27
yes.
years ago.
The industry was too.
It really, really was. Now,
an industry.
There was.
Yes. But technologically speaking, the difference is back then, it was when CDs were brand new, believe it or not, and they hadn't really gotten it right. The transferring from recording on big analog tape. Like we all did back in the day. There weren't computers and all that stuff. You had to do it the hard way in a big studio, right? But to get it from that, which sounded wonderful when we got done with that, to dither it down onto a CD, it got really, really small. And no one had the technology to actually bridge that gap and make it sound same for same. And here we are all these years later, and they've got it nailed. Our problem was our label, Geffen Records, got sold 5-6 times. Since we recorded back then, they owned the masters. They misplaced the master for the After the Rain record, which is ironic. You know, you sell 5 million records of an album. You would think they'd take better care of it. Move after move, it got misplaced. Bottom line is, after all these years, Matthew worked for about 2 years talking to what is now MCA, who actually technically has the rights to it. And they physically sent somebody down after years of saying, we've lost the master, we don't know where it is. And they actually found it in a mislabeled box. And what that enabled us to do for the first time in 27 years was use modern technology to go back into the studio and what's called remaster the album. And make
a lot
it
of people overuse
like,
that. They overuse that term, I think. You see it on a lot of stuff. Remastered, digitally remastered. Well, that just means they transferred it. In our case, we really did fix it. We fixed some problems that were inherent in it. Not changed the music, but made it what it was, as Gunnar was saying, over the big speakers in the studio when we recorded it. It actually sounds like it's present. It sounds like you're in the room. The soundstage just got a whole lot wider and deeper. And as a bass player, we were losing a lot of low-end information on the first album that sold all the records. I can't really complain. It sold a lot of records. But mm-hmm. for us to hear this back now, and we serviced radio and the streaming services with the new masters as well, but the first time you can actually buy this is on this vinyl that we released on, I guess, 180-gram vinyl, which is an audiophile thing, from a company called Friday Music. And we're really honored, though, because they consider the album one of the classics now. They don't reissue a lot of these albums. So for us, we're in really, really
we're a fine company. And, yeah. and it, as Matt mentioned, it's an honor. But for us, it's kind of one of those things that we kind of left hanging there that was frustrating. We would hear our song come back over Hair Nation or something on Sirius XM, and it would sound half as loud and half as wide as everything else that was there. And it was really unfair. And now that's all been fixed, and it's pretty cool. It was a very emotional experience to hear it back for the first time, because it really was sounding, for the first time in all of those years, the exact way we heard it on the big mains at Cherokee Studios there in Hollywood.
So this is the exact same album. You didn't add any songs?
We didn't add any songs. Something? The only thing that we did was we did a slightly different packaging, where we did mm-hmm. a song-by-song description for the people who've made this this album and the songs on this album a part of their lives. Now they get to hear from us kind of the stories and the motivations behind each song, where they came from, how they were written, what they meant to us, what they did. That you wouldn't really get in a magazine or in any other interview. We didn't really open up about it. So we actually did that.
We did that, and I think it's important to note, too, that this is an album. We actually created this to be one cohesive experience where you drop the needle. When we originally recorded it, there was a side A and a side B. You had cassettes, so you had to flip them over, that type of thing. So it was theater of the mind. We actually really put something together and took a lot of time to make it right. So a lot of people that grew up with the album, that's how they experienced it for the first time. You know, the song starts with the big hit mm-hmm. and just rolls right through. And by the time the album ends, you've been on a journey with us.
And that's what people used to do, and we missed that.
Yes.
You know, I listen to everything about
world now.
Well, everything about albums, like real vinyl albums, mm-hmm. is inconvenient.
Right.
And that's
right.
What makes them awesome. Because for the first time, think about this. What music used to be, it used to be our primary focus. Mm-hmm. When a band that you loved would come out with an album, there was a time when you'd rush down to the record store, you'd buy the album, and you'd take it home, and for that first listen, you'd sit on your bed, you'd drop that needle, you'd open up the artwork, you'd have something to read and something to look at, and you would take the time to do nothing else. You weren't texting. You weren't multitasking in any way. You were listening to the music that you loved. Now, it's unfortunate. You know, we've got kids now and stuff, and things have changed. And it seems that music, for the most part, has become background noise. Mm. It's something in the background. It's an ancillary. And with an album, a vinyl LP, you are back to, you have to take the time to put that platter on. And, you know, it's a breath of fresh air mm-hmm. to take an hour out of your life and really go on a musical journey. I love it. I'm fresh back into it. Just bought a system for myself. You don't have to go crazy with it. But, I mean, some of my favorite records are on vinyl. And they were all done as an experience, start to finish.
Right.
From the first song to the end, they were designed to take you someplace.
Right.
Just ask to the, you know, billion people that bought Dark Side of the Moon. That's what it's supposed to do for you. And, obviously, I think this is going to be the closest we get to all of those records that we grew up with that we loved. That got us into music in the first place.
Hmm. It's interesting, you know, things are like kind of cyclical because it goes around and, you know, you can cherry pick songs. They sell them as singles.
Yeah.
They had singles.
It's a singles market
30, 40
again.
Years ago.
That's right. Well, you know, it's also.
It's kind of like when our dad started, if you really think about
exactly.
it. It's kind of come full circle that way. You really didn't care about even the B-side. You just wanted to have that hit. And it has gotten back to that with one minor exception. People aren't buying it. They're getting it for free, and if they can't get it for free, you talk to any kid under 25, they have never paid for
music. Well, you talk to any kid, and you just tell them, I tell my kids, you know, anything given is never appreciated. You know, it's one of those things. But a lot of love and a lot of time and a lot of care goes into everything that musicians do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we actually do stay up until 4 in the morning and agonize over a kick drum sound. You know, we care.
Right.
And you just hope that someone out there actually does. And in the whole vinyl world, all of those people care enough to actually be inconvenienced. Mm-hmm. By, and it's pretty cool. So this is
kind of a rediscovery for us, you know, Friday Music, that actually came to us and really got behind the second, as Gunnar said, it was kind of a two waves of trying to find these master tapes. It really helped that there was a company saying, hey, we think you have a classic album, we want to reissue it and spend the money to do it. I mean, these things aren't cheap to do, you know, unit cost is high, but there are people out there that collect these audiophile grade 180 gram vinyls because they're precious. Mm-hmm. And for us, it was neat to rediscover that there are people out there that care as much as we do or more,
yeah,
that know all about the recording sessions, which musicians were on it, what those musicians are doing now. Mm. Everything has a story. And our After the Rain album, and we have a big story, but that first album in particular was really a coming of age for us and a redemption after a lot of false starts, dealing with our own grief and becoming men and having something to say on our own after growing up in some pretty crazy circumstances, not only with the family we grew up with, but like a lot of kids that came out of the 70s and early 80s, you know, our parents were divorced horribly. And
we were latchkey kids,
yeah,
too.
So yeah, we were latchkey kids. And for us, our music was and bands and things like that, that was our salvation. Mm-hmm. That was our way out of the ghetto of our minds. And so for us, this isn't just, hey, we wanted to be famous. This was something we live still on a daily basis. You know, we play music because we love it. We genuinely love this. And I think the coolest thing now that our dad's been gone for as long as he has, and even our grandparents, if you do really good work, excellent work, that we do, not just for ourselves, but hopefully in 3 minutes, maybe we can make somebody's life a little bit better.
You know, we also get to write our own script, unlike a lot of the actors that are out there. The songs have always been things that we've written. They're parts of us. And, you know, I hope that people throughout the years have gotten to know a little bit about us through those songs, and they become little time machines, little milestones and memories for people. I don't know about you, but if I listen to a particular song, I'm instantly back at a particular time.
Sure.
Mm. Or with a particular person.
We all connect.
Yeah, right. And it's pretty great. And, you know, the thing is that the making music for the Nelson family, even though we come from actors and sports people too, but for us, making music is not, it's not what we do. It's really who we are. I can't imagine not playing music. I mean, I really can't. And there are far easier ways to make a living. Trust me. There really are. But I can't think of a better way, mm-hmm, to do that. And we're in the, as Grandma Harriet says, boys, if you're going to do this for a living, realize you're not in the entertainment business. Nelsons have never been in the entertainment business. We've been in the connection business. Always keep that in mind. And that's what they really did great. And we were really blessed to see that in our father. He never had a yo babe sort of moment. He took time. You worked with him.
Yes.
Shakes your hand, looks you in the eye, and listens to you. And it's important for people. And so we feel like, you know, kind of we've got this opportunity throughout all of these years to connect with people and make a difference. It's not being trite. It's really honestly what's always motivated us. And, you know, a career is a series of comebacks, just like life is. Mm-hmm. But
that was our dad. He said that a lot.
But we have this really great opportunity if we play our cards right. Every now and again, you catch a lick, and hopefully it's going to be with the song that you wrote that really makes a difference in people's lives.
Well, I'm very excited that you guys were, you know, are willing to come here and talk and open up like this. And I was very excited when I heard that you were willing to do it, because it brought back memories to me. And just listening to you speak now brings back fond memories, because I spoke to you, I don't know, 35 or so years ago.
Sure. Wow.
In another market,
yeah,
you know, when we're all a lot younger than we are today. But
what are you trying to say?
Yeah, well, I was younger. I was 10.
That's right. That's right. I was 6.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
We got Matthew and Gunnar. They are Nelson. We're going to ask if you do another song for us.
Sure.
Hang on. I'll just...
Still got more ground to cover and more questions to ask, so...
Oh, okay. This is one that started it, and we actually wrote this song as a... Well, people think it was a typical relationship song. It wasn't. This one actually was written about a friend of ours we grew up with. And he kind of went in a different direction. We didn't know if that friendship was going to rekindle or not. And my favorite line in this song is, "Don't be afraid to lose what was never meant to be." It's a song called After the Rain.
a fantasy and you can't let go. He never really loved you from the start. The only thing he ever gave you was a broken heart. Don't be afraid to lose what was never meant to be. You're thinking if you break away, you'll never survive. Yeah, I'm waiting as my heart beats just for you. Come on and take my hand and I'll pull you through.
Nelson, After the Rain, title track to the new album.
That's right, title track to the new old album.
The new old, recently remastered,
completely better.
Bigger
record.
And better and fewer calories.
Well, Matthew's better at least. He is.
So how's the tour going? You guys having fun?
It's a never-ending thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of one of those things. It's changed. It's a little different than it was back in the day. Currently, right now, we're not out on a bus tour. When we went out on the After the Rain tour, we were out for 13 straight months. It was amazing. And something that I highly recommend.
Do when you're 22.
Correct. Yeah. You do it when you're 22.
Wow.
And it was a blast. Mm. It really honestly was. Playing to 22,000 screaming chicks every night was awesome. I highly recommend it. It was great. And now it's kind of cool. We play big shows. We play everything in between. As long as we're playing, we're happy.
Mm. And you get to play to different generations of fans as well.
Well, we do. We have a couple of different shows. Yeah. Now that you mentioned that.
Actually, Nelson is having a resurgence, which is interesting. It's weird when you start doing interviews and they say, so what's it feel like now that you're a classic rocker? You know?
I don't feel tardy.
We've actually kind of started to entertain offers to bring the whole project back in a bigger way, you know, in big arenas and events like that as an opening act for some really large bands. And I think we're going to be doing that next year. And
I prefer to think of it that the really large bands are closing for us.
Yes, I figured that. That's Gunner, sure. Then we have another show that we've been doing for a few years now called Ricky Nelson Remembered, and we get to visit our dad every night through his songs and tell stories and that type of thing. And that's actually something we thought was going to last about a year, and it's been a lot of years now that we've been doing it. It's kind of nice because it keeps us centered. And it's very almost like an Americana type of a trip.
We've spent about 10 years building it to a pretty fine show. It's a high-integrity show that's best described as like an A&E biography episode meets a rock concert. It's pretty cool. We have the unfair advantage of having those 435 episodes of Ozzy and Harriet.
Sure, sure.
That we can pull from. But you know, one thing we haven't done, which we'd love to do, our dad's reach internationally was huge. And the one thing that we want to focus on with that brand is actually taking that worldwide. That's what we'd love to go to
Europe. We'd love to go to South America with it, the Pacific Rim. His music really did get everywhere. And we'll see what happens with that. We've got some big plans for it. And, you know, we also have we actually put together a Christmas tour as well for the last couple of months of the year. Now this will be our fourth year. We head on out and we pretty much put everything away, put a completely different show together, not just like what a lot of artists do, throwing some Christmas songs in their show.
Sure.
We did a completely Christmas show and hit the ground running with that, and it's been really fun.
Well, I know the world is excited to hear the prospect of you guys touring internationally because we're on in 100 countries right now.
That's right. Well, fantastic. Nelson actually, too, did not get overseas enough. Mm-hmm. I know that we played maybe two shows in Brazil, you know, but it's interesting because we played one show in the United Kingdom in Nottingham, England, and we were the headline act at something called Firefest a couple of years ago, And it was the biggest club I've ever seen. I think it held 3,000 people. It was completely packed. Everybody there to see us. And it was people largely from other countries that kind of migrated to England to see us, to see Nelson play. Mm-hmm. And so we knew that there was a little bit of an interest there. And all we want to do is make sure that once we get overseas, that we bring a show that makes people really glad they waited this long to come see us. Mm. You know, fortunately for us, I think we still have our voices, which is nice. You know, we have a lot of friends that are fighting
that
now. Well,
Matthew does anyway.
He sounds pretty good. Yeah. But we're not ready to hang it up. You know, we definitely play like we mean it every show. We play every show like it's our last. And all we want is the opportunity, actually, to bring our music overseas, whether it be Ricky Nelson Remembered or Nelson or both, mm-hmm. would be awesome.
Because I thought, how cool would it be to, like, do a matinee of Ricky Nelson Remembered, flip the room, and come back out with Nelson.
With a rock show.
That'd be cool.
We'd love to do it. We love being musically schizophrenic. We have a good time.
Sounds like a cruise in the making to me.
Yeah, that's right. Those Nelsons, they're a great bunch of guys.
The Wacky Nelson Cruise. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Matthew and Gunnar are our guests here on The Voice of America today, on the road for After the Rain Remastered and putting out the hits all these years. Now, you talk about the Ricky Nelson Remembered show. What is each one of you, I'm sure, has his own remembrance of your dad, has your fondest memory.
Oh, gosh, I got so many of them.
Yeah, so if you could single out something, you know, a couple, whatever, something that comes to mind, you say, when I think of my dad, this is always something I cherish about.
He was really funny.
The smell of Polo and menthol cigarettes.
That's right.
Polo cologne and menthol cigarettes.
Okay, yeah. Well, okay, something came up recently. Like I mentioned, we just turned 50, so we just had our 50th birthday. There's a tradition that our father began that is ongoing now, that on your birthday, at some point, and he was clearly a Three Stooges fan, you were going to get a whipped cream pie in the face at some point during the 24 hours that mark your birthday. It's going to happen.
We grew up completely paranoid on our birthday.
Now, our dad was the master pie placer of all time. He truly was.
And it wasn't pie throw. There's a big difference.
Yeah, if you actually, we learned, and he taught us, if you throw a pie, people's instincts take over and they duck and you'll miss. There's an optimum speed, an optimal speed for placement of the pie where a person looks at it and goes, oh, is that a pie? And then it's white out. Okay.
Right.
Okay. So our dad was just the best at this. I, by the way, got completely pied by my 11-year-old. She was wonderful at it. I was very proud. My 50th. But we were turning 13, and our father was playing at Astroworld in Houston. And we'd gone through the entire day, peeking around corners, nervous. Matt was a lookout. I was a lookout. We were waiting for that pie to happen. And, you know, our dad was playing Astroworld. It was like a Six Flags. It's a big amusement park.
They had one heck of a roller coaster.
Oh, it was killer. Yeah.
The American Eagle. Yep.
Yeah. I thought it was the Texas Cyclone.
Nope. That was a different place.
Okay. And, like I said, we never missed an amusement park gig our dad had. And that was a great way to spend our 13th birthday. We didn't have school. He flew us down to Texas. We got to ride the rides in the park all day, see his show twice, both shows he played. And we had gone through the entire day, no pie. And we were wondering what was up. We kind of felt a little let down because, you know, you have to watch out for the band, too, because it's not just our dad. You're fair game, right?
Sure.
And they're great, too. Nothing. And it's like 11:50 at night. The day is almost past. We're sitting there having a conversation with our pop in his hotel room. He's actually got his back to us, and he's shaving, talking to us through the mirror. We have a 20, 30-minute conversation, talk about life, how the day we had, how proud he was of us that we're growing into men now, and that the whole shtick, right? And then all of a sudden, he goes, ow, 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 and he bends over in the sink like he cut his face. The entire time, he had a pie hidden in the sink. So we go, Pop, are you okay? And, man, he nailed us. Nailed us. And, that's one of the things that I remember from
our
father.
He always said to us, you know, don't lose your sense of humor. You're going to need it. And it's really true. I don't care who you are and what you do. It sure helps in the music industry. But, you know, in the world, you know, don't lose your sense of humor. Mm. It helps. It helps you get through stuff. And for me, it was just a conversation we had after he actually saw a show that we played about 2 weeks before we lost him. And it was in the kitchen. And always the great talks happened in the kitchen. The sun was coming up. And we had one of those life-defining talks, and as the sun came up, he said, you know, I want you guys to know I love you. And I said, well, I love you too, Pop. He said, no, it's more than that. I want you to know that I admire you guys as my peers. I consider you my peers. I'm really proud of you guys. And, you know, tears and hugs and all that kind of stuff, and we lost him 2 weeks later. And it's just so nice that we actually got a chance to have that most people never get that.
Right.
You know, it's Field of Dreams time, you know. Yeah. So for us, we're very lucky that we had that.
And you hold on to forever.
I'd rather have him here.
But, of course.
You know, that's not a bad thing to have.
Yeah. And growing up around all of that was going on with your father, mm-hmm. I mean, at 12, 13 years of age, all the groupies. I mean, you're just young, prepubescent kids.
We didn't really realize that he was as special as he truly was until he like came to parent-teacher day at school, and the teachers were freaking out. The girls, the women were freaking out. And it's like, oh, I guess he's doing something remarkable.
Great.
Which was great. And, you know, it's kind of cool for us, too. You know, it's been wonderful being from the family that we're from. But we were lucky enough to sell the records we sold, and we've sold so far, to kids who had no idea who Ricky was.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't grow up with his music. It was their parents and the critics that were impressed. But the kids just liked what they liked.
Right.
Which was cool. But it's the same thing for our father because, you know, it's important to note that Ozzy had his own number ones. You know, he had his big band.
Sure.
And so the music that he was making, and that's how he met Harriet. He was advertising for a chanteuse, and he found her. They had a number one in 1935, and music at the time was very specific for its generation, just like our dad's music was very specific. And he wound up smuggling rock and roll into mainstream American living rooms at a critical time in its history. And our music wasn't anything like our father's music.
Right.
Which was cool. But every generation of Nelson did their own thing. But the through line has always been entertaining and connecting with people.
Mm. Well, the difference between your grandfather's days and your father's days is the girls weren't throwing their underwear at the
stage. That's not true.
Oh, really?
True.
Oh, really?
Women were... Yeah. He was actually, believe it or not, Ozzy was a heartthrob for his day.
He was a good-looking guy.
He was a good-looking guy, and there were women after him plenty. And with our dad, it was a little bit different in the sense that he was impossibly good-looking. He was a really... just had this... Elvis had the same thing. It was this charisma that rolled off of him.
Right.
And, you know, he was a married guy, but it was the 70s, so I think those lines were blurred a little bit on both ends of our parents' lives. But the truth behind that was I've never in my life seen anybody have more women throw themselves at somebody than he did. He
right.
just
yes.
he wasn't looking for it. He was almost shy. If you spent time around him, he was almost embarrassed about it. But women were unbelievably forward with
right.
him.
And he came out at a time when Elvis was on the scene, too, and the two of them were always...
That was it. Right,
they were on the magazines,
they were dueling it out on the charts. And,
yes, yes.
And they had a nice little friendly rivalry. They were friends, but they actually liked to one-up each other.
Mm-hmm.
So much so, they got to the point where they had the hubris to do the same songs a couple of months apart from each other just to see who would chart it higher. You know, and they both had one guy in common. We're really good friends with James Burton, our dad's legendary guitar player. The founding father of rock and roll guitar. And James is still out there just burning up the Telecaster and being a mentor.
Or 78 now.
And he's playing, great, and teaching us not only guitar but wisdom and all that. And it's really kind of cool to be able to talk to a guy who was really there at ground zero when rock and roll was born.
Yes.
And, you know, all those guys down in Memphis were doing their own thing. Elvis was doing his thing with Sam Phillips. We found that rock and roll is kind of regional. You know, the New York scene was the doo-wop scene. And then our dad and...
it was Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent. You know, that was the California thing at the time. And, you know, travel was...
Rockabilly.
Yeah, rockabilly. I mean, travel wasn't really... Yeah, our dad was really the Hollywood hillbilly. I mean, it was... travel wasn't what it is now, and you couldn't get around. And Sam Phillips is famous for saying we would assign Ricky to our label in a second to Sun Records, but he had to do that damn TV show.
And Ozzy was too smart. Ozzy was brilliant.
Yeah,
right?
Ozzy was a genius. He really was.
And he was also a lawyer. People didn't know that. He negotiated all the contracts, and people didn't know that he had a law degree.
That's why he wound up owning the family show without the network really catching on to what was going on. But the guy wrote, produced, edited, directed, and starred in all 435 episodes of that show. You know, it reminds me of an interview I saw with Betty White when she started out for Channel 5 in L.A. Television was brand new, and she was doing stuff live all day. She had
like 3 hours of a show, and it was all live, no script. Just go.
You know, and she worked every day, 7 days a week, for the first 10 years of her career doing that, just because that's kind of what she did.
Right.
You didn't really know any differently. You know, and our grandpa Ozzy... You know, he put that show together, and he picked ABC as the network, which was the smallest of the big three. This was at a time when you had three channels and a local. That was it. There were four things to watch on television. So when America tuned in to see your show, all of America really tuned in to see your show because they didn't have any other options.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really cool to, I mean, imagine being Ricky Nelson at a time like that when rock and roll was really considered race music for the most part. You know, it was a fringe thing.
Yes. Well, they couldn't even call it rock and roll on TV. It wouldn't pass the censors.
Right.
Yeah, it was. They had to refer to it as rhythm and blues. It was a completely different time. And you know, you actually make a decision at that point as a family franchise that supposedly stood for something to really, honestly, midwife that dangerous outlaw art form into mainstream American living rooms. And our father just happened to be the right guy at the right time to do that. You know, I mean, who knows? I'm not saying that he should take credit for actually something bigger than it was, but he really did kind of at a critical time legitimize the art form to millions and millions of people.
Well, and also Ozzie and Harriet actually took some shots at the beginning there.
Oh, they
too
did, yeah.
So he had parents that had their foundation was music and mm-hmm. and being in a dance band and doing it that way. They worked hard playing music. So, you know, I guess Harriet was the only time she ever addressed any kind of a social comment or something on the Ozzie and Harriet show.
They always felt that their job was to make people forget about what was going on in the world. Yeah. With the show. So they intentionally made Ozzy not have a job on the show. He didn't want to remind people that people had to work.
Right.
That was a choice.
You know, so all that stuff, they thought about it. But Harriet actually went on and our dad asked, you know, they were getting a lot of hate mail. You know, how could you have Ricky Nelson do the devil's music on your show? What kind of parents are you? And, she, you know, Harriet was a babe back in her day. And she was the first big band chick singer.
She was singing at the Cotton Club when she was 15. So honestly,
they're barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah,
and she addressed it on the show.
Right parents to address that, you know, culturally at that time, mm-hmm. and something to be really proud of.
Yeah, I don't
you
think
know?
That people know how much rock and roll owes to Ozzy and Harriet.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm here. I agree with you guys. And again, I mean, what a thrill it is to have you here. The time is flying by. And I know, and
we
I
talk a lot, man.
No, that's okay, because I know you got a lot of things going on, and you're in town for, you know, a show that you're attending tonight, and then you're off on the road for your own tour, and so you're...
Yes.
But yeah.
We're actually here for this. This is why
this,
we came
yeah, well,
in.
That's true.
This.
You came here for I this mean, show.
Yes. No, really, honestly, we
and
are...
And the Foo Fighters were secondary.
And they actually,
that was just
this.
An added plus.
That was... We ran into a friend at the baggage claim. We came here for this because this is honestly something that is a privilege for us
well,
to get to
you.
Do.
Did you tell Dave Grohl you were doing this?
Not yet. I will tonight.
Okay, well, you got to say, well, when we I came up, here for this, Dave, you're second. Dave.
When I show up in makeup, I have to explain where it came from.
Okay.
Yes.
Could you do another song for us?
Sure.
You know what? I want to do one of Pop's tunes, if that's okay.
Oh, that'd be fantastic.
What do you want to do?
How about... Here's a tune that he wrote in 1971, okay. At the end of 71. He was booed off the stage at Madison Square Garden for showing up and looking different than people expected him. It was an oldie show. And he wrote, he got booed off the stage. He wrote a song about the experience, and it became one of his biggest hits,
Garden
if not
Party.
His biggest ever. Can't please everyone.
Oh, can't
you
please
everyone. You gotta please yourself. Garden Party.
At one, two, three.
To a garden party to reminisce with my old friends, a chance to share old memories and play our songs again. When I got to the garden party, they all knew my name. No one recognized me, I didn't look the same, but it's all right now. I learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself. People came from miles around, everyone was there. Yoko brought a walrus, there was magic in the air. And over in the corner, much to my surprise, Mr. Hughes hid in Dylan's shoes, wearing his disguise. But it's all right now, I learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself. A la-da-da,
la-da-da-da,
la-da-da-da. Well, you
got to please yourself.
Wow, they're standing all around the world. Gosh, what? Hair on my back is standing up there. My gosh, congratulations on all the success, and thank you
thank
guys
you
so
much.
Much.
Thanks for having us.
Please come back.
We'd love to.
You. We'd love to have you back.
And our love to everybody out there listening to this. It's a wonderful thing to actually have the ability to talk and talk to and reach so many people out there.
And thank you for standing by us for all these years. We really do appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate all the great music you have given and continue to give.
Thank you.
So After the Rain Remastered, pick up a copy. It is Nelson, Matthew, and Gunner joining us today. This is Border Crossings on the Voice of America. That's it for today's show. Thank you, Matthew and Gunner Nelson, for joining us on the show today. It was fun talking to them today, just as it was fun when I first viewed them back in the 1980s. Wow. And they look the same. I'm getting older, but they haven't gotten any older. They sound great, too. Thank you so much, Nelson, for joining us on today's show. And thanks, Vince, our director and producer for today's show. And I thank you for listening to Border Crossings. I will return again soon with more Border Crossings programs for you, requests and dedications and special guests, and our Now 64 CD giveaway, which will resume again next week on Border Crossings. Thanks for listening. This is the VOA1 Music Network.